You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, this is Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate today. We're said to be in a war against terror, or a war against terrorism, or a war against Al-Qaeda. A war against terror is wrong. Terror is a feeling. A war against terrorism or terrorists, that's a tactic. That's not an enemy. And a war against Al-Qaeda may be becoming a less than useful concept. Not only is Osama bin Laden dead, his group, The Cell, has ceased to be a potent force. So says Fawaz Jurjez, author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. It's been published by Oxford University Press, and Professor Jurjez joins me now. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
When Al-Qaeda successfully attacked the U.S. in its most horrific and most horrible success, and before that they attacked the U.S. coal successfully, they bombed the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, it was logical to assume that they were getting better and more potent and we would have more to fear from them, but that hasn't exactly turned out to be the case. Why not?
I think one of the major challenges facing the United States in the 1990s and 2001 on the morning after 9/11 was to understand the nature of the threat that Al-Qaeda represented. Al-Qaeda was dangerous. Al-Qaeda is dangerous. The attacks throughout the 1990s, in particular the second part of the 1990s and 9/11, showed very clearly that Al-Qaeda had the capacity, the will, and the resources basically to attack the American homeland and basically inflict great damage on the United States. Al-Qaeda represented a security irritant, a security nuisance to the United States. Al-Qaeda has never represented a strategic existential threat to the United States. What American policymakers did after 9/11 was to confuse the security irritant that Al-Qaeda represented with an existential threat, and they waged a global war on terror. The global war on terror basically played into Al-Qaeda's hand. In fact, Al-Qaeda could not have survived beyond 2002 if it was not for the American war on terror. The American war on terror was the oxygen that has sustained Al-Qaeda in the last 7 years.
As a recruiting mechanism?
For a variety of reasons. The American invasion of Iraq was one of the most important decisions made by Bush and company, and basically not only provided Al-Qaeda with a recruiting tool, but also in the eyes of many Muslims and many Arabs, the United States was waging a war against Islam and Muslims. And thus, Al-Qaeda used that particular invasion of Iraq in order to recruit fighters, in order to convince a critical segment of the Muslim community that the United States was at war with the Muslim world, as opposed to being at war with Al-Qaeda.
Why didn't that argument have carried much water during the invasion of Afghanistan?
And this is the critical point. In fact, when the United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, even though many Muslims basically disagreed with the United States and wanted the United States to basically use legal tools in order to bring Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri to justice, you did not see a river of recruits going to Afghanistan to basically fight on behalf of Al-Qaeda. In fact, Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri has replaced Osama bin Laden as the chief of Al-Qaeda, believed that if the United States had invaded Afghanistan, a river of recruits would flood to Afghanistan and fight the American forces. And guess what? Only a trickle of fighters basically went to Afghanistan and fought on behalf of Al-Qaeda, because Arabs and Muslims realized that basically the United States had little choice but to go to Afghanistan and try to dislodge Al-Qaeda from the heartland of Afghanistan, while Iraq was an entirely different project. Iraq had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. There was no operational relationship between the Saddam Hussein regime of Iraq and Al-Qaeda. In fact, the invasion of Iraq had little to do with Al-Qaeda. The invasion of Iraq was an ideological project advanced by President Bush and neoconservatives in order to social engineer basically change in the heartland of the Arab world. And in this particular sense, the American response to 9/11, particularly the expansion of the war on terror, basically played directly into the hands of Al-Qaeda. Because remember, Mike, Al-Qaeda's strategy throughout the 1990s up to the present was to do what? to basically embroil the United States in the lands of Islam, basically to bring the United States boots on the ground and bleed the United States by 1,000 cuts. And that's exactly what the United States did after 9/11. It played into al-Qaeda's hand. It fought the war on al-Qaeda's term. And that's why the global war on terror was the oxygen right. that sustained al-Qaeda after 2002.
Why would al-Qaeda have withered in 2002 had it not been for the war in Iraq? They had this horrible success, but almost a mind-bogglingly successful mission in bringing down the World Trade Center.
You're absolutely correct. Truly, the 9/11 attacks exceeded the wildest expectations of Osama bin Laden. He said it himself immediately after 9/11. He did not really expect. And you might say, Mike, you know, explain, how did al-Qaeda succeed? First of all, it took al-Qaeda 2 years, at least 2 years, to plan the 9/11 attacks. It had brilliant managers, field lieutenants, basically, who planned the attacks. And also, what we need to understand is that there was a massive failure on the part of the American security apparatus. People have, as you know, conspiracies that somehow the CIA knew about. It's nonsense. All systems fail. And also, I think the decisive factor, luck. Luck played a key role in the success of the 9/11 attacks. So while we should...
Because there was, for everything that you say, wow, that was brilliant to have planted the terrorists, or that was lucky to have not been noticed in a flight school, so many things had to go right.
Absolutely.
And if one did not go wrong, it could have tripped up the whole operation.
In fact, Mike, the CIA had knowledge about two of the operators and who were in California, and it would have taken just one single... piece of, if you connect the dots. It did not. It happened. The truth is the United States failed on 9/11, before 9/11, to basically uncover the operation. Still, bloody as they were, insidious as they were, painful as they were, the 9/11 attacks were not a transformative event in world history. Throughout history, Mike, such attacks have taken place in history. In fact, my argument in my book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, America's response to the attacks on the morning after 9/11 turned 9/11 into a transformative event. What do I mean by that? A transformative event, in fact, America's response, the global war on terror, has triggered a major shift in world politics and world economics. In fact, shift from the American unipolar system in international politics and economics to a multipolar system with multiple sources of powers, including China and Brazil and India and other powers. What I'm trying to say is that the global war on terror waged by the United States not only was counterproductive, it weakened the United States, it limited the influence of the United States, it was costly in blood and treasure. I call al-Qaeda, in my book, the $5 trillion project. Al-Qaeda, which never numbered more than between 1,000 and 2,000, 3,000 fighters at the height of its power on the morning 2001, the United States has spent almost $5 trillion U.S. dollars in direct and indirect costs trying to hunt for 1,000 fighters, 1,000 militants. This tells you about the nature of the threat, which was a security irritant, and America's response, which was strategic and existential. Huge gap between the two.
We're speaking with Fawaz Jurjez, author of The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, his new book that is out by Oxford University Press. We were told that, or perhaps people that, you know, went a little bit beyond the headlines, got the information that Al-Qaeda's power might not necessarily be what that group of 1,000 fighting men could do, but their power would be as a brand and as a franchise. Did that come to pass?
Not at all. In fact, what I try to do in the book is to really lay to rest some of the myth and interpretations about al-Qaeda. First of all, al-Qaeda never represented a strategic existential threat to the United States or even to the Muslim community. Secondly, there was no huge coalition of Muslims who basically joined the global jihad. The global jihad of al-Qaeda variety has always been a fringe, never resonated with Arab and the Muslim world. In fact, again, to come back, really, this book is not just about the history of al-Qaeda. It's about how America's response basically complicated and brought about counterproductive results. In fact, and I'm sorry to say it, I really say it with a heavy heart, America's response to 9/11 has basically created more terrorists. Let me tell you what I mean by that. There were no local affiliates before 9/11. Most of Al-Qaeda, the Al-Qaeda organization, existed in Afghanistan. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, never. Not even a single small little tiny fringe in Al-Qaeda. America's attack and invasion and occupation of Iraq created one of the largest Al-Qaeda groups probably in the international system.
So when we look at a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or now we hear a lot about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, are they not really an affiliate of Al-Qaeda? Are they just using the name Al-Qaeda?
Well, this is a different situation about the relationship between local affiliates. And even though Al-Qaeda Central basically is really no longer exist as an organization now, you have local groups. So you have Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. You have Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Even though they subscribe to the global ideology of Al-Qaeda, their actions really are localized. They are really local organization. They're basically, their basic mandate, their basic mission is local. Let me give you an idea what I mean in terms of examples. When Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq between 2003 and 2006 when he was killed by American forces. In fact, what he did, what Zarqawi did in Iraq, was contrary to the interest of Al-Qaeda Central, of Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri. They urged them throughout, please slow down, don't kill civilians, don't attack Shiite Iraqis. In fact, your actions are turning the Muslim community against Al-Qaeda itself. And guess what? Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi, the local affiliate in Iraq, did exactly what he wanted to do.
Right.
He never listened. In fact, his actions turned the Muslim community against Al-Qaeda. Iraq was the graveyard of Al-Qaeda.
To the point, turned against Al-Qaeda, I was fascinated to read in your book a small anecdote about Zawahiri doing essentially a town hall meeting online where he's assailed by Muslims saying, and these are people who knew the password, you know, these are people who are at least affiliated enough to get into that town hall meeting saying, how do you justify the killing of innocents? How do you justify the killings of Muslims?
You're absolutely correct. In fact, Osama bin Laden, the first time in history, he went out publicly in 2007 and apologized to Muslims for the actions of one of his lieutenants, Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi, in Iraq. He realized the damage done because Muslims came to realize Al-Qaeda was not a friend of the Muslim community. Al-Qaeda was shedding innocent blood. Ayman Zawahiri went also public, as you said, in a town hall and basically tried to answer questions. And most of the questions were saying, why are you shedding Muslim blood? Muslims came to realize that Al-Qaeda was basically a terrorist organization. Al-Qaeda was not a friend of the Muslim community.
Even if we saw images of some celebrations from Palestinian refugee camps after the attacks, and there certainly was a sentiment, born of whatever, you could say born of evil, born of frustration, born of ignorance, someone took a slingshot and brought down the towers of this great world power. So even though we saw those images, it always struck me that if anyone ever read Al-Qaeda's platform, if you will, it's deeply nihilistic. It never promises, sure, we want to have the return of the caliphate, but, you know, where can you read anything that Al-Qaeda's written and think that they're going to be able to engineer a society that delivers the mail and provides for clean water? It just doesn't exist. So I wasn't getting that, but was the Muslim world really not reacting to their so-called platform in the way that we were told they were, that they really believed in Al-Qaeda's ideals?
No, Mike, really, one of the major myths that gained momentum in the United States after 9/11 is that somehow Al-Qaeda was part and parcel of an ideological coalition against Western values and American values. Think about what was the most popular questions after 9/11. Why they hate us so much?
Right.
Every time I went on television, every time, even on NPR, the question was, and think, it was one thing to say, why does Al-Qaeda hate us so much? It was another thing to say, why Muslims hate us so much? Reductionist, simplistic questions. In fact, some of the most important religious authorities in the Muslim world came out against Al-Qaeda on 9/11. And in my book, my previous book, The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global, I tell the story of the rise of the global jihad. I show how, some of the major leading authorities, religious authorities, basically said what Al-Qaeda did was un-Islamic. Al-Qaeda violated the ethical foundation of the institution of jihad of the Muslim communities. And yes, you're absolutely correct. Some Palestinian kids celebrated in Palestinian camps. A lot of resentment against American foreign policy. Many people remember, we are the greatest power in the international system. Some of our actions alienated many people in that part of the world.
Right. Many people have only had a diet of propaganda and don't know the truth.
Absolutely. Right. Ignorance. And also, we have to put things in context and perspective. It's one thing to say, why we didn't focus on the tens of thousands of Iranians on the streets, on the morning after, with scandals, basically showing empathy with the United States. I was in the Middle East a few days after 9/11. Truly across the board, there was a great deal of empathy. In terms of everyone I talked to. I mean, Le Monde, one of the leading leftist newspapers in France, said, we're all Americans now. Why shall we focus on a few Palestinian kids who live in refugee camps and basically lump Al-Qaeda with the Muslim community?
I'm speaking with Fawaz Jerjez, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. He just mentioned The Far Enemy, his old book. We'll talk about that in a moment, and we'll continue talking about his new book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, published by Oxford University Press. We'll be back with more after this break. Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopez today, speaking with Fawaz Jerjez, author of the new book, The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. You made a reference to the far enemy, and this is the concept that jihad used to be localized in their own backyard, and then there was the concept of global jihad. Has this been a success?
Dismal failure. The truth is, the global jihad of Al-Qaeda variety never resonated in Muslim lands. If we have learned one lesson in the last 8 months, Mike, about the Arab Spring, about the popular uprisings in the Arab world, is that there's a huge divide between the Arab world and Al-Qaeda's ideology. The pulse of the Arab street is not about the global jihad. The pulse of the Arab streets, as we have seen in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, in Bahrain, in Yemen, is basically what? Bread and butter and freedom, jobs, quality of life, separation of powers, and the rallying cry, dignity. This tells you a great deal about how we in the United States misunderstood the pulse of the Arab streets, and we lumped the Arab and the Muslim world with Al-Qaeda, and that's exactly what Al-Qaeda wanted us to do. In fact, in the late 1990s, Ayman Zawahiri, who is now the emir of Al-Qaeda, wrote memos to his lieutenants, his Egyptian lieutenants, saying, you must join me in the global jihad against the United States. Remember, the movement, the Islamist militant family, has always been near enemy, as opposed to far enemy.
Right.
That is focused on local Arab and Muslim leaders as opposed to the United States. It was not just in the 1990s that the global jihad burst into the scene. So his lieutenants told him, look, are you crazy? We could not take on the near enemy, and you're taking on the United States of America. And guess what Ayman Zawahiri wrote in his memos? He said the ship was sinking, the ship of the near enemy militant family. The only way to rescue the militant ship is to target the United States of America. He called America the head of the snake. And once we target the United States of America, America would lash out angrily against the Muslim community. And once it does, we, militants and Islamists, would rise up and defend the Ummah, the Muslim community. We would gain credibility in the eyes of the Ummah. That was the strategy of Ayman Zawahiri in 1999, captured documents we found in Afghanistan. Their strategy was to force the United States to get embroiled in Muslim lands and basically, portray the war not as a war between the United States and the global jihad, but as a war between the United States and the Muslim community. And guess what, too, Mike? We did exactly what Al-Qaeda wants us to do. Instead of declaring basically a police and security campaign against Al-Qaeda, we declared a global war on terror, and we went basically to the deserts of Arabia in order to social engineer change.
I have seen and heard commentators assessing, well, what does the Arab Spring mean? Who knows who will lead Egypt? And I'll ask you about that. But in the last Republican debate, even on the question of who will lead Libya, Michelle Bachmann said, well, it could be someone who believes in the caliphate. It could be some radical. When you compare it to who was leading Libya, who was Khomeini, who couldn't be Gaddafi, who couldn't be worse, who couldn't be a worse leader perhaps in world history, to fear what comes next as compared to Gaddafi seems, you know, wildly implausible. So what do you think the worst case scenario is for who will be the leadership, even if a version of the Islamic Brotherhood comes to have a leadership role in Egypt?
There is no Ayatollah Khomeini. spearheading the Arab revolutions. I mean, this is for sure. The revolutions in the Arab world are not about an Islamic-based state versus a secular state. These are really revolutions about what you and I and all of us, universal values, about employment, quality of life, separations of powers, dignity. I'm not suggesting, Mike, that the Islamists, the religiously based activists like the Muslim Brotherhood, are not a major player. They are. But I would argue neither Libya nor Egypt nor Tunisia will be governed by an Ayatollah Khomeini like Iran. It's going to take a long time. There are no institutions. The pro-Western leaders who govern Tunisia and Egypt and even Libya in the last few years, as you know, the West has tried to bring Gaddafi out of the wilderness because of what happened after 9/11. He was a major player in the war on terror. Remember, we, the United States and Britain, we delivered some of the suspects to him, some of the ones, the militant Islamists. The reality is this particular journey in the Arab world will take between 1 and 2 decades. It's not going to be easy. You're going to have social turmoil. You're going to have political struggle. That's normal. And, Mike, most important about that part of the world, there are no institutions. It's an institutional wasteland. An institutional building will take time. There will be setbacks. But we Americans, we must realize the first time in 600 years, the people now have spoken. They're trying to own their own history and create societies and institutions that are functional and also they are legitimate. And, in fact, President Obama, I mean, did the right thing by, of course, I mean, belatedly embracing the democratic waves in the region. I hope that President Obama does not just pay lip service to what's happening in the region. I hope he takes real initiatives in order to help reconstruct state and societies in that part of the world.
I think I almost meant by my question, even if the most virulent version of the Islamic Brotherhood as they currently are constituted, even if they gain sway in Egypt, it won't be as if Al-Qaeda is running Egypt. I mean, what would that be like if kind of a worst case scenario for the United States in terms of Egyptian leadership?
You know, Mike, since 9/11 now, we have lost, really, we in the United States, our commentators and politicians, in particular the politicians you mentioned in the debate, about differences, about context, about, tensions and distinctions. Al-Qaeda is a beast by its own. Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with the Muslim Brotherhood. If some of the Republican candidates had read what Ayman Zawahiri wrote in the 1980s and 1990s, some of his most vehement attacks were against the Muslim Brotherhood. And guess why, Mike? The Muslim Brotherhood is a mainstream Islamist movement that believes in the political game, because the Muslim Brotherhood believes in constitutional-based government. It believes in elections. It believes in the rules of the political game. I'm not suggesting that the Muslim Brotherhood is a born-again Democrat. That's not the question. But they are not Al-Qaeda-like organization. They are a mainstream Islamist organization with its own agenda, and it has evolved a great deal in the last 20 years. Of course, it still has a longer way to go, but the reality is they're fragmented and splintered. So you have the old guard, and you have the enlightened Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood who will be running for president is an enlightened liberal like the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan. Of course, you have generational differences between the Muslim Brotherhood. The young Muslim brothers are as open-minded and democratic as their secular part in Egypt. So no, even if the Muslim Brotherhood gains power in Egypt, Egypt will not be governed by a militant ideology. It will be more like Turkey rather than Iran.
This is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Fawez Jurjez, author of The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. So assess what the death of Osama bin Laden means for Al-Qaeda and the global jihad movement as it is.
Al-Qaeda no longer exists as an effective organization. It's at the height of its power, 1,000 or so fighters. We're talking about now dozens. 2-3 dozens of fighters, most of them unskilled. Most of the skilled managers and lieutenants are gone, eliminated. No shelters, no refuge in most of the part of the world. Now, Al-Qaeda Central is basically in Pakistan's tribal areas. No command and control. They don't really have the capacity, literally starving for recruits, no recruits whatsoever. And, of course, the killing of Osama bin Laden, the charismatic leader, a unifying force within Al-Qaeda. So even though Ayman Zawahiri now is the chief, the emir of Al-Qaeda, he is not a unifying figure.
Should they have, if they were acting in their own self-interest, have chosen a different leader than Zawahiri?
Absolutely, but there was no one else. Zawahiri has been there since the beginning, at the creation of al-Qaeda in the 1990s. He's also the most master theorist of al-Qaeda. I mean, Zawahiri was, you might say, the spiritual, really, godfather.
Yeah, and he tried to instruct bin Laden, and bin Laden would say, I don't like reading.
Absolutely, but Ayman Zawahiri has been a disaster.
Yeah.
He is one of the worst military commanders you can ever have. I mean, his history speaks for itself. So the reality is, even though, I mean, the death of Osama bin Laden was a major blow to al-Qaeda Central, the al-Qaeda organization no longer exists.
Well, what about funding? We were always told that bin Laden was sitting on this billion-dollar construction fortune as the most prominent Saudi family. What about the money?
You know, Mike, gone. Literally starving. Guess what American forces found in his house in Pakistan? 500 euros. If you and I will go to any European country, you and I, can we survive for 2 days on 500 euros? What does it tell
you? Well, I can. I don't know what kind of hotels you stay in.
Well,
but
I mean, 500
yeah,
euros.
Exactly.
I mean, this is, what does it tell you? It
right.
tells you there's a huge divide between the image of al-Qaeda is starving, not only for resources, starving for skilled recruits. The reason why al-Qaeda does not have the capacity to carry out attacks along the 9/11 lines, it does not have the managers, the skilled lieutenants, the capacity, you know, what it
yes.
takes, and the shelter and the recruits. So in a way, if you're asking me about al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda has suffered a catastrophic military defeat. But let me go further. One final... It's not just about the military defeat. To me, the military, al-Qaeda could easily, I mean, God forbid, we might wake up tomorrow and see al-Qaeda carrying out an attack in the United States, a single attack, as opposed to, that's not the question. But ideologically, the ideology of al-Qaeda now suffers from a massive crisis because what the Arab Springs and what the Arab revolutions have shown, there is no, its ideology does not resonate. It does not have anything to offer to Arab and Muslim societies.
There's a study that you cite, a study in the Pakistan Northwest Frontier, which was once a stronghold for pro-Al-Qaeda sentiment, saw a 66% decline in support for bin Laden from August 2007 to January 2008. So what does that mean for the PR value that the United States hoped to have gotten from killing bin Laden?
Well, I mean, remember, Osama bin Laden was a pivotal player, the most pivotal player in the global jihad. His charisma, his very presence, his very, basically, was a mobilizing, an inspirational value for many recruits. So in this particular sense, it was a huge coup for the United States and also for the American leadership. For the United States in particular, for many Americans, the very survival, the very presence of Osama bin Laden reminded him of the pain that he inflicted on America. So psychologically and symbolically for the United States, but let me go further and be blunt. Basically, al-Qaeda's crisis is not about leadership. Al-Qaeda's crisis is structural. And before Osama bin Laden and after Osama bin Laden, the global jihad is dead as an ideology, even though there are some major... And here I want to qualify what I have said. I am not suggesting that terrorism will not be with us for the next decade. In fact, terrorism will be an integral part of globalization. So you have homegrown radicalization now. You have local groups like al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, al-Qaeda in Iraq and other places. But the reality is we need to find ways and means to live with terrorism, to really prevent terrorism, not by waging a global war on terror, but also to realize that there is no absolute security. No system can provide... You and I... can happen to us outside if we leave the building today. This is the President of the United States, Barack Obama, I was hoping, should educate the American public that even though Al-Qaeda Central no longer exists, that terrorism, unfortunately, will be part of the international system. And one attack might succeed, one of these days. I hope I am wrong on this particular. We should not, I mean, the American people should not use terrorism in order to continue to think of al-Qaeda and terrorism as an existential strategic threat.
So
final point
about
my book, really. One of the major arguments I make on the rise and fall of al-Qaeda is that terrorism and al-Qaeda have taken hold of the American imagination. Literally, there's a huge disconnect between the nature of the threat that terrorism represents to America and also how Americans feel about terrorism. That is, I mean, literally taken hold of the American imagination. It is time not only to put closure to America's global war on terror, it's time to educate the American public and show the American public that terrorism does not represent an immediate and present threat to their way of life.
And so the homegrown American terrorists seem like bumblers or fumble fists or radicals who were never going to come. Maybe perhaps the bomber of Times Square would have gotten away with something, though I have read that his bombs weren't even sophisticated enough to do his job. It doesn't seem, even though there have been dozens of arrests, the narrative is usually would-be terrorist gets in with an American undercover agent, and perhaps, you know, his lawyer will usually argue the American undercover agents push the supposed terrorist in a direction he didn't want to go. But yeah, he, for the most part, many of these prosecutions have found that these individuals were willing to go forward with terrorism. But it doesn't seem that scary. Am I just kidding myself?
No, you're not. But we should be concerned
right.
about homegrown radicalization. It concerns all of us to find some American young man and woman who are basically relatively very integrated in American society buying into this particular ideology. The question is not whether we should be concerned or not. The question is why? What explain? What are the drivers behind this particular phenomenon? And in my book, and this is really a very important question, have you ever heard one policymaker in the United States or a security expert, terrorism expert, drawing a link between America's war on terror and homegrown terrorism? You'll never hear it.
It's rare,
because
yeah.
we bury our heads in the sand and we say it's all about insidious, evil ideology of Al-Qaeda. Ideology matters in the book, in the rise, and I really call on readers to the last chapter. I show a causal link between homegrown terrorism and America's war on terror. Iraq, between 2003 and 2006, was a major recruiting tool, now Afghanistan and Pakistan. And you have this fringe. It's a small, tiny, as you said, element, but America's wars, unfortunately, have convinced some young Muslims who live in Western societies that the United States is waging a war against their own communities and faith.
I've been speaking with Fawaz Jerjez, director of the Middle East Center of the London School of Economics and the author of The Rise and Fall of Al-Qaeda, published by Oxford University Press. Professor, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Mike.